today's topic, which is the final chapter. So we have looked at an answer yesterday. We have seen what they are, where are they located in the genome. We have looked at the markers, the chromatin marker, that are present, that mark an answer region. Today I want to finish this chapter by discussing a couple of features of promoter activation, which basically brings things together. We have said that an answer, obviously it's in the name, that can enhance transcription from the core promoter. The question is how it does it, and there are two aspects to it. One is the fact that our enhancers are actively transcribed in enhancer RNAs, and we'll see what they are and how people think they may work. To be honest, we don't really know how they work. And then we'll look at the feature of enhancer promoter looping. We have seen it in many figures, we have seen it in the movie, but we have not really looked into how it's established and why it's there. Okay, so if we go back to the one of the slides that we looked at yesterday, you may remember that two different types of promoters, of enhancer that have been described, are enhancer in a poised versus active conformation. And we discussed a number of the features that differentiate these two states of enhancer. We have looked at nucleosome occupancy, we have looked at histone marks. One thing that we failed to discuss is the fact that right here there may be pool two already assembled, depending on the stage of poising. However, pool two is inactive, whereas one clear feature of active enhancer is the fact that there is transcription occurring from RNA polymerase two, and so therefore the synthesis of transcript that are called eRNAs, because they are enhancer-associated RNAs. So, what are eRNAs and what are their main features? As I said, they are RNAs that are their transcript that are associated from enhancer regions. So, they are transcribed from a region that are distal from the gene that they potentially regulate, and there are a few things that have been observed. As I said, this is a pretty new area, so the results that we'll be discussing are things that have been observed in the last few years, five years. There is still an active debate of what is the function of enhancer RNA, how they work. There are people that are more that believe that they play a very important role, so other people that are not yet convinced. So things may change in the next few years as people continue to research this topic. But these are the features that have been observed so far. So the first thing is that is pretty much established is the fact that as you have active enhancer, there is transcription of transcript from the enhancer area. So enhancer are associated with transcript. The second thing is that the transcription of enhancer RNA is not constant, is responsive to induction. And this has been observed in a couple of different situations that we'll look at. The third thing is that eRNAs are very unstable, and this is actually one of the main reasons for which part of the scientific community is not convinced that they play an important role. When I say that they are really unstable, I mean that they are their lifetime is in the range of a few minutes. And so obviously one thing that you may wonder is if they are transcribed and they last for such a short time, how can they play a critical role? At the beginning, it was thought that maybe they could act in trance, and so they could be transcribed and then move and go to regulate other transcriptional areas. it's hard to believe that in such a short time they can have a critical role. However, the opposite argument is that all the events that we have been discussed yesterday are very dynamic ones. They are things that happen within seconds and minutes, so it's very possible that even RNAs that have a short life can play a role, and they are just continuously produced so that the moment you want to interrupt transcription, you stop their transcription and they don't hang out there continuing the signaling event. The other thing is that that is what suggests that they play a role, is the fact that they are quantitatively correlated with the mRNA of genes that are potentially regulated by those enhancers. So if you consider one enhancer that has been associated with the regulation of a certain coding area, and you look at the amount of RNA that is transcribed from this region and from this region, those are quantitatively correlated. So the higher the activity of the enhancer in terms of transcription, the higher is the activity of the regulated gene. And so that suggests that those two processes go together. However, it's not a functional correlation. We'll see that there are some proof of a functional role. However, this is the area that still need proofing. And then the last thing is that they're mainly, they lack poly-A, they are poly-A negative. Okay, so as I said, the first thing is that that is established is the fact that RNA transcription is associated with enhancer. And this is the first paper that reported transcription of RNA from enhancer region. It's a paper from, I think, 2010, in which they identified transcription of about 12,000 transcription of RNA from about 12,000 neuron-specific enhancer. So this was the first time that people realized that there was the production of transcript associated with enhancers. And a couple of points from this paper is that, first of all, they identified the neuron, the enhancers from the neuron in by ChIP-seq, looking for CBP. So this is about what we discussed yesterday, the fact that not always the enhancers that are selected, identified by chromatin histone marks or by the presence of a specific transcription factor are proved functionally. So these are enhancers that correspond to the definition of enhancer in terms of chromatin marks and factor binding, not necessarily their active enhancer. But then the first thing they did was to look in their cell types, which are neurons, and look for what are the enhancer that appear to be their active working. And then they did ChIP-seq for RNAPOL2, and they realized that RNAPOL2 is generally associated with enhancer. And at that point, you could, before we knew about the enhancer RNAs, you could imagine two different hypotheses. One where the fact that you detect RNAPOL2 at the enhancer level is because the enhancer loops over the promoter, and so the POL2 that you are detecting is actually the one of the promoter. And that's been a debate for a while. However, I think now it's pretty well established that the alternative hypothesis is the correct one. And so the POL2 that you are detecting is not the one that is over the promoter, but it's POL2 that it's really recruited at the level of the enhancer. And that's an active POL2 because you can find RNA transcripts that are associated with those region with transcriptional star sites that are located within the enhancer area. And then the last thing they show is what I mentioned before, the fact that when they start looking at the level of this enhancer RNA in the cell, they found that it's correlated with the level of the RNA of the potentially regulated genes. Now, once you accept the idea that there is transcription occurring from an answer region, basically an answer RNA becomes another class of transcript, right? So if you think about what we discussed during the previous module, the transcriptome is the collection of all the transcripts present in the cell. So it's the collection of mRNAs, non-coding RNAs, and among all those, it's also included the enhancer RNAs. It's just a different class of transcript, non-coding transcript. And so, in fact, if you go back to the research paper that we have for the previous module, the one from the ENCODE project about transcriptomes, there was a chapter that we didn't discuss. I said we'll talk about it later. About the characterization of enhancer RNA. So when they go through the discussion of all the different classes of transcript, the long non-coding, the short non-coding, they also discuss the idea of enhancer RNA. And so the observation that they make in that paper are taken from using the collection of RNA-seq data and CAGE data that they have used for all their transcriptomic analysis, but focusing their studies on transcript that may be associated with enhancer areas. So in order to do that, they use they define enhancer using also ENCODE data. The beauty of the ENCODE project is that you have all these different sub-projects that allow to be integrated together, right? And so within the ENCODE project, there are ChIP-seq data for transcription factor, for cofactor, for histone modification. And so they use those data to define enhancers in a number of cell types. If I remember correctly, it's 5 or 6 cell types. And then they integrate, and then they use this list of enhancers to look at the transcript that may be associated with these enhancers, okay? And so this is what this first panel shows. They focus on potential enhancer based on histone marks and factor binding, and then they look at what kind of RNAs are associated with it. And they look at 3 different data sets. They look at CAGE, and they show that there is clear signal from the center of the enhancers that I look at. And so this indicates that there are transcription star sites for transcript within the enhancer area. And then they look at poly-A plus and poly-A minus RNA-seq, and they also see that there are transcripts, so there are transcripts that are identified by RNA-seq that are located within the enhancer area. 2 features here to remember. The first thing is that there is RNA production in both directions. So this is one of the features about enhancer RNA. They are usually bidirectional. The other thing to observe is the fact that the signal from the poly-A fraction is much higher than the poly-A plus. So the poly-A minus is higher than the poly-A plus. And this is why in the previous slide I said the enhancer RNA are usually poly-A negative. However, please notice that that this is not a flat line. So this indicates that there are more enhancer RNAs that are poly-A minus than enhancer RNAs that are poly-A plus, but not that there are not that none of the RNAs, enhancer RNAs, poly-A, polyadenylated, okay? Then the second thing they did was to compare the feature of these transcripts that are associated with the enhancer with the one that they had previously recorded on promoters. And so this is what this graph represents. Here you have transcripts that are associated with enhancers, and they compare it with transcripts that are associated with promoters, either the one that are already annotated or the new one that they have identified through the ENCODE project. And what they look at is what they look like, whether they are associated with different features. And so, as we saw here, they conclude that enhanced RNAs are usually less polyadenylated than regular RNA that are associated with promoters. They are mostly located within the nucleus, so they are not exported in the cytosol. If you remember from that paper, they looked at the location of the RNAs and they compared the RNAs that were in the cytosol fraction with the RNA in the nuclear fraction. And so they described the fact that enhanced RNAs stay in the nucleus, which makes sense because if you think about the fact that they are transcribed from the enhancer and they are very short-lived, there is not that much time to translocate out of the nucleus. And then the last thing they look is the level of H3K4 methylation that is associated with them. And they say that there is much less H3K4 methylation associated with the region where the transcripts are produced. And that, again, is not a big surprise because we know that enhancers are mostly associated with H3K4 monomethyl. H3K4 trimethyl is a marker of promoter activity. And then the third thing they do is to compare the histone mark, the chromatin remodeling, the chromatin status of enhancer by comparing enhancer that are transcribed and enhancer that are non-transcribed. In order to do that, they use cage data to separate enhancer where they don't see any signal from enhancer where they do see signal. And if you think about it, this can be considered as a different way to separate active enhancer from non-active enhancer because you're looking only at enhancer based on all those markers. And then we said that active transcription is a marker of active enhancer. And so if you compare enhancer where you do see transcription with enhancer where you don't find transcription, then you are basically comparing active and inactive enhancer. And in fact, you see the expected rate in H3K27 acetylation, for example. The ones that are known, where you don't see transcription, have a much lower level of H3K27 acetylation. And so this is it's an additional confirmation that transcription is found associated with the active enhancer. Oh, and then the last thing is just that this transcription from enhancer is cell-specific, which is expected if you think that enhancer have a function that is cell-specific. So in each different cell, you find different enhancer being active at each single time. The same thing is for transcription. So what they do here is that they look at enhancer that are active, where they do see they are active first, they have H3K27 acetylation, and where they do see transcription in one cell type, this GM is a cell type, and then they look at whether the same enhancer are also active and they also have transcription ongoing in other different cell types, and they found that the answer is no. So this is a confirmation then there is an association between active enhancer and active transcription in a cell-specific manner. Okay, so these two papers and a few others show that there is transcription. As I said, this is well established. They show that the transcription is regulated. This is something I forgot to mention, but the way in which they did the experiment for the neuronal, study, they actually activate the neurons. So they look at enhancers that are activated. But the question is, are these enhancer RNA functional? None of the studies has addressed this question. It may be that there is just some spurious transcription going on from the enhancer, just because, and that's the argument that some people use. that because you assemble the whole machinery, the same protein can interact, and so you have RNA-Pol2 there, and you have some little transcription going on. However, it's not a productive transcription, it's non-coding, the RNAs are unstable, and they get degraded faster. Okay? So what this paper has tried to do is to show that there is a functional correlation, and that enhancer RNAs are required to regulate the transcription of genes that are regulated by a certain enhancer. That was the goal of the paper. And so what they did was, first of all, to show that there is enhancer RNA transcription in an estrogen-stimulated system. So they use their own system. It's breast cancer cell, MCF7 cells, where they look at estrogen activation, so the same system where we have seen a number of studies this week. And then they look at whether there is transcription going from enhancer of genes that are regulated by estrogen and by estrogen receptor. And they prove that there is enhancer transcription activated in a ligand-dependent way. In order to do that, they do GrowSeq. So you remember, by GrowSeq you measure the amount of transcription. So you are looking only at the nascent mRNA production. So you look at the process of transcription, not the RNA that is accumulated, and they do that in absence or presence of estrogen, and then they look at whether there is transcription observed over enhancer areas that have been associated with estrogen stimulation. So if you look at this heat map, the line in these heat maps are not all the genes or all the location, but they are all the enhancer that have been associated with estrogen activity. So it's they look at a specific subset of potential enhancer, the one from which you would expect transcription. They don't look at all enhancer, which would not be regulated by estrogen. And then they compare plus and minus estrogen, and as you can see, it becomes much darker plus estrogen. This indicates that there is increased transcription from these enhancers upon estrogen stimulation. The other thing they do is that they do, when they prepare the library for sequencing, they do single strand preparation. And so if you remember when we looked at RNA-seq, you can do the same thing for the GrowSeq. You can prepare a library with both strands are analyzed at the same time, or you can do a single strand preparation. And by doing that, they measure the transcription from these enhancer areas on one strand and on the other strand. And these allow them to show that there is bidirectional production of enhancer. This was shown before also from the ENCODE paper. And so these estrogen-stimulated enhancer have transcription going in both direction in an estrogen-stimulated manner. Then the second thing they tried to prove was that these enhancer are functional. This is the biggest point of this study. And to do that, they down-regulated the enhancer RNA in a couple of different ways. So they just use the same approach that you would use for a coding RNA. They use sRNA, but they use sRNA-mediated down-regulation, not against the coding RNA, but against the enhancer RNA. And then in order to make sure that the results they see is correct and is not something due to a specific activity of the sRNA, they also block the enhancer RNA in a different way, which is something that is called LNA, which is locked nucleic acid. It's just a different way of down-regulate things, similar to an sRNA approach, but it's different. They are oligos that are stable. They form hybrid, and they inhibit the target RNA in that way. Okay, so what they then look at is the regulation of transcription from a few couples of enhancer promoter genes. So what they do is that based on the growth seek, and this is an important point, based on the growth seek, they select 10 genes that are highly regulated by estrogen and that have enhancer areas that are close by and that show enhancer RNA production in an estrogen-stimulated manner. Does this mean that those enhancer are proven enhancer of the related genes? The answer is not. And the reason why I'm making this point is because yesterday a few people asked me whether when you're looking for enhancer regulated genes, why people look for the close ones. And it's a correct question. There is no guarantee that the gene that is nearby is regulated by that enhancer. It's very possible that that particular enhancer regulates a gene that is 3, 4, 5 genes away, and that is not so. By looking only at the one that nearby, you may not find the right target. Here, instead of choosing genes that for which the enhancer function was proven, they went with this approach because they wanted to make sure that they were looking at couples where both the enhancer RNA and the coding RNA were regulated together by estrogen. And so that's why they selected genes this way. What they observed is that it looks like the enhancer RNA are required for the regulation of the downstream or the nearby gene. Because if you look here, you can see that when they compare an siRNA control versus an siRNA that is against the enhancer RNA, you lose the activation, disactivation in response to estrogen. You lose the activation in response to estrogen on both the enhancer and the associated gene. So this couple, for example, is the TFF1 gene, which is the same, the PS2 gene that we discussed yesterday. So it's a gene that is highly upregulated in response to estrogen. This is the measure of the coding RNA activity, transcription. This is the measurement of the level of transcription from the enhancer region. And so you can see that by eliminating the enhancer RNA, you are also inhibiting the activation of the coding gene that is a few kb downstream or upstream, I don't remember. And they have done the same thing for a number of genes, I think it's about 10, and they see the same thing for all of them. Even more importantly, they look at the growth seek track for one of these enhancer RNA downregulation. So if you think about for each of these cases, they have to downregulate a different enhancer RNA. So for the TFF1, they downregulate the enhancer RNA of the TFF1 enhancer. For the NRP1, they downregulate the enhancer of that particular gene. So it would have been a huge effort to do growth seek for all of them. So they do it only for one. They use the FOXC enhancer RNA. They downregulate it using this LNA approach, and then they do growth seek. And what they found is that if you compare, so first of all, they have a control. So they show that if you look at the transcription of an unrelated gene, which is in this case GRPDH, you don't see any change. So whether you downregulate that enhancer RNA or not doesn't change. So you don't have global changes in transcription in the cell. And then they look at the FOXC1 locus. So in this case, the enhancer is downstream from the gene. And you can see that in the control experiment, there is transcription from the enhancer area as well as transcription from the gene. The question they are trying to ask is whether if they downregulate the enhancer RNA that is produced from the enhancer, whether they affect transcription of the coding gene. And this is what they observe. So it's not very easy to see it here, but there is a decrease. This one is smaller than this, and this is the quantification here. So the amount of transcription from the gene is downregulated, even though the transcription from the enhancer is not changed. So what you are doing is that you are blocking the function of the enhancer RNA after it's been transcribed. You are not blocking the transcription of the enhancer RNA. And so the transcription from the enhancer RNA is still fine. You can see it here. However, once the enhancer RNA is transcribed, then it gets inhibited by the LNAe oligos. And this has an effect on the transcription of the regulated gene. And so I think this is, for now, one of the best proof that there is a functional effect of these enhancer RNAs. The remaining question is, what are these enhancer RNA doing? And so they propose that enhancer RNAs might be required to regulate enhancer promoter looping. There is not too much data in this paper that really support this hypothesis. What they show is that there is an association between the enhancer RNA and some of the machinery that is required for enhancer promoter looping. But that's the idea that is out there, and it's one of the possible models. One of the possible models is that enhancer RNA that are produced at the the enhancer level help establishing the loop or helps stabilizing the loop as it forms. So because of that, the next thing we should discuss is enhancer promoter looping. So we have seen many pictures like this, right, where there is connection between enhancer region and promoter, these big loops. How can we really, these are drawings of obviously, but how can we study this process in cells? Can we measure these long range interactions somehow? And then the other type of question that we should address are, which are the mediators of this interaction? How does it get established? And then one question that is still out there is whether the looping is functional. Is it required? And this, really, there is no clear answer to it right now. There are evidences that suggest it clearly happens. The question is whether it's important or not, it's required, and there is still ongoing debate about that. Okay, so first thing, how do we study it? How can we measure long-range interaction? The approach that is used is an assay that is called 3C, as chromosome conformation capture, 3C, C, C, C. The chromosome conformation capture assay is, in a way, it's similar to a chip. It's a little bit of a modified version. You don't have protein involved, it's just DNA. What you do is, if you think about it, when the looping occurs, these two pieces of DNA are in very close proximity, right? So if the looping occurs, you all of a sudden find pieces of DNA that were once far away, very close together. So if you cross-link them together, then you can potentially stabilize this interaction, extract the DNA, deproteinize it, and then digest it and get pieces like this. So the idea of digesting it is it's based on the fact that you want to isolate only the piece that is brought together. And so in order to do that, you can use restriction enzymes that are represented all across the genome. And there are certain ones that work better than others because they are represented with a more regular frequency. And so there are a few that are normally used for 3C. And then once you cut it, you have these two ends that are now close enough that if you do a ligation, you just add the ligase to this mixture, they can be ligated together. And so you do a ligation in a... The ligation conditions are optimized so that you use very little amount of ligases, and so only things that are close enough are ligated. So this is called the intramolecular ligation. So you don't want to use so much ligases that even things that are just in the mix together will be ligated. And this is a critical point because you use the ligation as a way to detect the fact that those two pieces were close by. If you use enough ligases that you ligate everything, then the purpose is lost. So the condition of these experiments are critical. And then once it's ligated, then you decrosslink, and then you can detect whether this interaction occurred or not by using PCR primers. Okay. This is just the same representation, different ways. Again, you cut with the restriction enzyme. These ends are closed if the looping had occurred. And so you can ligate this and then do PCR. One possible variation, obviously, at the end you can do normal PCR or you can go genome-wide. We'll discuss the genome-wide a little bit later. One possible variation of this is the Chia PET approach, which is very similar, but instead of identifying every possible loop, you are specifically looking for the loop that involves the protein you are interested in. So let's say you are studying estrogen receptor and you want to look at the loops where estrogen receptor is located. And so you do the same approach, but you also do an immunoprecipitation step where you immunoprecipitate for your protein of interest, estrogen receptor. And so it helps concentrating the material and selecting only the one that you are interested in, and it has a little bit of a better resolution. Okay, so by doing this, people have proved that looping occurs. And actually, probably the first, I think, example of looping that was confirmed by 3C analysis was the one of the beta globin locus. So we discussed the beta globin locus yesterday. It's beta globin genes are clustered together and they are differentially expressed during development. There is an embryonic form of beta globin, couple of different fetal form of beta globin, and then once you get into the adult, you start expressing the adult beta globin in the liver. So the expression of these genes is regulated by what at that time was called the LCR, now would probably be considered a super enhancer. Okay, and so what this paper did was to try to see whether there was looping of different regions within the LCR and the adult beta globin gene. And this was because within this very large area was required, but within this very large area there are basically 6 or 7 enhancers that are present. At that time they were described based on hypersensitive site. So there were 7 main hypersensitive sites where chromatin was open and that were required for the expression. But there is also an hypersensitive site down here. And so they wanted to see the contribution of this different enhancer on gene activation. So this is the same figure, but from the paper. So it's a little bit more complicated because they also describe all the primers. Don't worry too much about them. Don't be confused by the nomenclature of the gene that is slightly different. It's just because the picture that I showed you, the picture that I showed you here is for the human beta globin. They do their experiment in the mouse one. So the nomenclature of the gene is slightly different, but the idea is the same. There are 6 enhancers here in the locus control region. Couple of them are separated upstream, and then the one downstream. And they want to see whether there is looping over the beta globin gene. And so they use a 3C approach, just like the one that we described. What they compare are samples from that are taken from embryo at 14.5 day of development. Comparing the liver and the brain. And the reason why they compare these two tissues is to have a situation where beta globin is not expressed and a situation where beta globin is expressed. And so they expect to see looping in the situation in which the enhancer, the locus control region, is active and so the gene are expressed, and not to see looping in the condition in which the gene are not expressed. Okay. And so then here they just show the controls, they show that all the primer work, that they don't have non-specific ligation. And then here they represent the result. So this looks like a very busy slide, but once you understand how it is designed, it does make sense. So what they do is that they do PCR using different couple of primers. Okay, so they have one fixed primer that is the one, in this case, over this beta globin gene form. So there are two beta globin gene forms, a major and a minor. Here they look at this particular one. And so they have this fixed primer. And then they combine this primer with primers that are all across the rest of the locus. So they are trying to see which part of the, what they are asking in this particular one is which part of the locus get in proximity of this particular gene. And so if you see here, they compare, in blue is the brain where the gene is not expressed, and in red is the liver where the gene is expressed. And you can see there are clear differences. If you can see this region, for example, is not looping in the brain, but it's looping in the liver, because all of a sudden you get increased PCR signal, which indicates that there is looping, and so you start detecting the two pieces together. And so this suggests that this area, which is part of the locus control gene, is looping with this gene. And they do the same thing with a lot of different primers. It's a very complex study. In this particular case, they do the opposite. Their fixed primer, this black line here, their fixed primer is one of the enhancer region. And then they look at what loops with this, and they see exactly the opposite. So they found that this region loops with the beta globin, both genes here. There is a clear signal, okay? Does it make sense? I know it looks complicated, so if you need me to repeat, no. Okay. There is more, it's just more of the same thing, looking at how all the region loops. And so by combining all these results together, they get maps like this, where what they show is that there is not one single loop. So it's not like you find only a specific interaction from one of these hypersensitive sites and the gene. What they found is that you can observe looping of many different areas within the locus control region and the gene, but you also find looping with this other enhancer that was a downstream enhancer, as well as looping with this larger region. And so this was one of the first indications that there are multiple long-range interactions for each gene that is regulated. And this, in a way, if you think about it, it's not too surprising, because if you think about the when yesterday we did the calculation of how many enhancers there are and how much the enhancer number overcome the promoter numbers, there is a large number of enhancers that are available for each promoter. So that allows the interaction, the usage of different enhancer in different times, but also the use of multiple enhancer at once. And so some way to represent this this type of relationship is this one that you often find now in papers and reviews. It's this flower representation with all the petals. And this shows the fact that if you consider a single gene, there may be multiple region, enhancer region, that will loop over the promoters. And so you have this loop of chromatin that are excluded from this interaction area. And all of them cooperate together. Now, one question that you may ask is whether these things are all are all interacting at the same time or not, right? And I would say we don't know the answer. Many of them may be interacting at the same time. It is known that there are cases where certain genes are regulated by multiple enhancers in the same tissue. But you also have to consider that all these experiments are done using cell population. They're not done in single cell. And so the fact that you are detecting interaction between all these units could mean that they're all looping together and they form that flower, or it could mean that in different cells you have different interaction. And so in one cell you have one loop and in another cell you have another loop. This particular paper, it's particularly complicated because they're doing the 3C analysis from the whole brain. So think about how many cell types there are in the brain or the liver. It's very possible that there are differences between subpopulation of cells. So the problem is that these things should be analyzed at the single cell level if we really want to get a better understanding. Right now, there are still technical limitations to do 3C, 4C, all the different genomic approaches at the single cell level. There have been a lot of studies where they have tried to address this question by using FISH. FISH is it's an imaging approach and can be used at the single cell level. However, the resolution is much lower. And so you see things getting in proximity, and this has shown that sometimes there are cases of multiple enhancer interaction with one single gene. But if it's would it be impossible to make genome-wide maps based on FISH? So stay tuned. I guess in the next 5 years we'll probably figure out exactly how these things work. Okay, and then yes, I think this is a good time for a break, if you like, and then we can discuss the mechanism that support the looping. So we can start back 10 minutes at 10. Okay, so we have seen that the loops exist, that promoter and enhancer get in close proximity somehow. We can detect them using the 3C approach. The question is, how is this looping happening? What is the mechanism that allows for the establishment of these different conformation? So if we, first of all, it's not completely understood, but if we go back to the review that we have looked at for enhancer function and enhancer specification, we can see that there are a few things here that are listed as potential looping promoting factor. So this is the classic picture that we have seen many times. You have a promoter which is bound by the RNA polymerase, the core promoter, and often some it's bound by the RNA polymerase, the pre-initiation complex, as well as some transcription factor that bind to proximal sites. This area is also bound by co-activators, and this includes, for example, things like the tissue-specific one, but also the mediator. And you can see that here listed among the looping promoter promoting factor is mediator itself. And there are a number of studies that suggest that the presence of mediator is required to establish the connection between the core promoter machinery with the distal transcription factor. And so you could imagine that the reason why the mediator is promoting this interaction is because it helps bringing the two elements in close proximity. One other factor that is often listed as a looping promoting factor is cohesin. Cohesin, I believe you have studied before in the context of chromatid association. It's basically a protein that helps establishing connection between the DNA strands. And then there is the idea that maybe there is a role for non-specific RNA binding proteins. And so we'll look a little bit more in the idea that RNA, and in particular non-coding RNA, may be important for promoting or maintaining the formation of this closer interaction between distal regulatory unit and promoter areas. So the first thing is the idea that mediator and proximal transcription factor may be important for the formation of the loop. And this comes from an older study where they look at the role of transcription factor, and particularly proximal binding transcription factor, for the formation of long-range enhancer promoter interaction. And so what they study is the interferon beta enhancer. If you remember, we looked at how the interferon beta enantiosome is assembled from a structural compositional standpoint yesterday. You may remember there are a number of transcription factors that assembled in order to form the enantiosome, and then there are HMGs protein that helps assembling things in the right conformation. One thing that we didn't discuss yesterday is the fact that the interferon enantiosome, it's actually not a distal enhancer, but it's a proximal enhancer. So it's located right next to the core promoter. So it's more of a proximal enhancer than a classic enhancer that is far away. So these offer the possibility of testing whether the position of the enhancer is important in mediating its transcriptional activation. And so what they did was to use a reporter system where they sometimes they call them enhancer assay, where you take an enhancer and then you place it in different positions upstream or downstream of the transcriptional starts of the core promoter, and then you look at the activation of the reporter. And in that way you can test the activity of the enhancer independently of its position in the sequence. And so they did this type of experiment, and they start moving the enhancer farther away from the core promoter. So they first started with a very little spacer, about 70 base pair, then they increase it to 200, 500, and then remove it all the way to 2 kb upstream. And as you can see, the activity of the reporter, so therefore the activity of the transcription that starts from this core promoter, dramatically drops when you move the enhancer far away from the promoter. And so this may be surprising because of everything we have been discussed about enhancer. They may be positioned everywhere, upstream, downstream. Their main feature is to regulate transcription from a distance. However, one thing to consider here is that this core promoter it's really just the core promoter. So it's what we discussed at the beginning. It's just the sequence, the Tata box, and the closer elements that are required to drive transcription, to sustain the basal transcription. Okay. So in this type of setup, right here on the core promoter, there aren't additional transcription factor. There is only the assembly of the peak. And so they ask whether it's the lack of other features of this core promoter alone that may be impairing the function of the enhancer. Okay. You can approach this in two different ways. You can say we move it and it's not active anymore, so it's not an enhancer. Or you can say there is something that is lacking here that doesn't allow this enhancer to function when we move it away. And so to test this hypothesis, they say, okay, so let's change this core promoter. And instead of putting just the core promoter, we put an artificial promoter that is has a core promoter but also has a binding site for SP1. SP1 is a transcription factor. It's a constitutive transcription factor, and it's a basic one that it's found in every cell type, every system, and there are very, very often SP1 binding site in the proximal promoter region. So it's not the tissue-specific inducible one. It's just a basic transcription factor. And what they find is that when they add this type of promoter here, then they can recover some of the activation of the reporter. So this suggests that now this could be able to work a little bit better, or that this is working on its own, right? So in order to exclude that possibility, they first remove SP1, and they show that SP1 is needed. And then they did the most important experiment, which is to take SP1, just the binding site for SP1, and place it next to the core promoter of the interferon beta gene. And so this is the situation where it's exactly like this one. There is all the endogenous sequences. They've only added a transcription factor binding site next to the core promoter, and that is sufficient to recover the activation, so the function of the enhancer. And this, together with other example of this kind, support the idea that the activity of an enhancer and the possibility of looping, in this case they don't do 3C, so they don't look at the looping per se, they look at the functional output of the looping. This would argue that in order for distal enhancer to work with the promoter, you also need elements on the promoter. And so the core promoter itself is not sufficient. You also need transcription factor on the core promoter. And this is probably because the assembly of the mediator requires different point of contact. As you remember, when we look at the mediator structure, it makes contact with different regulatory elements, with different regulatory machineries, as well as with the peak. Okay. The other idea is that the formation of this looping may be facilitated by RNAs, and in particular by non-coding RNAs. So where does this come from? This is one of the some of the work that support a role for RNA in promoting the looping. What they show in this paper is the fact that non-coding RNA can associate with mediator, and that this is promoting enhancer promoter looping. So there are non-coding RNAs that can bind to the mediator, and that they are required to promote the looping. So why do they consider this hypothesis, and what is the data that support this model? So they start from the observation that they had made in a previous paper, that there was a population of long non-coding RNAs that they had identified that were found to activate their neighboring genes, and they call them non-coding RNA activating or N-coding RNA A. So this is it's an interesting approach because it's kind of like the either side of what we just discussed before about an answer RNA. So what we have seen earlier this morning is the idea of people that have defined an answer, and then they have looked at whether there were transcripts associated with the answer, they found that there were enhancer RNAs, and then they looked at whether the enhancer RNA could regulate neighboring gene. This is the opposite approach. So they don't focus on enhancer, they focus on non-coding RNA. They were studying the function of non-coding RNA in the cell. And then they found that there was a population of non-coding RNA for which they could find an activating function towards neighboring gene. So in a way, these are enhancer-like RNAs because they can activate genes, but they didn't find them based on enhancer. They find them based on their activity, okay? It's a small group of non-coding RNA. It's not very large, but it seems to have a positive function. It was shown to have a positive function on the regulation of genes nearby. And so for seven of them, they did basically the same thing than it was done in the estrogen receptor paper we discussed before. They used sRNA to downregulate the non-coding RNA, and they looked at whether the expression of genes that were nearby was downregulated. Okay, so that proved that the non-coding RNA had the function to activate those genes. The only difference is that they don't call them enhancer RNA, and they didn't find them based on their presence in an enhancer. But in a way, they have an enhancer-like activity because they are transcripts that are produced somewhere here, and then they have a function on the activation of a gene nearby. Okay, so they want to understand how these non-coding RNA work, and so they do a series of experiments to try to understand how they work. The first thing they want to show is the fact that these non-coding RNA are absolutely required for regulating transcriptional activation, okay? And so to do that, in the previous paper they had shown that there was an effect of the nearby gene, but now they really want to study the mechanism of it, and so they want to show that it is the non-coding RNA per se that regulates transcription. And so they use a reporter system where they have luciferase with a promoter, and then here they insert the non-coding RNA locus downstream of the luciferase. The idea is that if this is transcribed, it's transcribed into a non-coding RNA, and then they want to see whether this non-coding RNA will regulate the expression of the luciferase. And as a control, they use a similar reporter where here they insert another genomic location. They don't want to. The good control is to do a similar approach, so they don't want to leave it with nothing, because otherwise this could be due not to the non-coding RNA per se, but just to the insertion of another genomic region. So they use an unrelated genomic region inserted here. And then they transfect these two vectors into HEK293 cells. Just a general, I don't know if you have used 293 cells, but they are cells that transfect very well, so they're very widely used for reporter studies. So nothing to do with the kidney per se, it's just a very well used cell type. Okay, and so what they look at then is the relative luciferase expression of one versus the other, and as you can see, if you compare the sRNA control for the sRNA against the enhancer RNA, you lose expression. So So this is the way to prove that there is a non-coding RNA that is transcribed from this genomic region. If it's there, it supports the expression of this luciferase reporter, because if we use an sRNA to downregulate this non-coding RNA, then the expression of the reporter is downregulated. And they do it with two different sRNA to show that, to confirm the result. Okay, so this confirmed that there is a transcriptional function for this non-coding RNA. And then they want to understand how it works. So they do like a mini screening. They test different things that may be important and try to see which one are linked to this non-coding RNA. And so they transfect sRNA against different components of the core machinery, of different transcription factor, of chromatin modifier, such as P300, and then they see what happens. And you can see that most of them don't have any effect, so whether you have them or not doesn't change. However, when they either downregulate the non-coding RNA, this is their positive control, or they downregulate MED12, then the effect of the non-coding RNA is impaired. Now, one thing to that may be confusing in this experiment is that you can say, why is you downregulate elements that are known to be important for transcription, why you are not having an effect, right? So this is because what they are looking at is the relative expression, it's not the absolute level. So this is not telling you that if you downregulate P300, transcription is still happening fine. It's just telling you that the relative expression between these two vectors changes or not. And because the difference between these two vectors is the presence of the region that encodes for the non-coding RNA, the reduction that you see is specific to the presence of the non-coding RNA, is not just an effect on the transcription of the plasmid per se. Okay, and then the third thing they do is to say, okay, this is just a validation. They have shown that it's important in this reporter system, but this is obviously different than the in vivo situation. And so they validate the same result by looking at the in vivo situation. So this is the locus where this particular non-coding RNA is expressed. It's expressed downstream of this gene that is called SNAL1. And so they, first of all, did the downregulate the non-coding RNA with the sRNA, and they look at the expression of different genes that are present in the locus. And they found that obviously the expression of the non-coding RNA itself is lost because you are measuring with the sRNA, you are downregulating it with the sRNA, but also that the expression of SNAL1, which is upstream, is partially reduced, as well as the expression of this AURK gene here is downregulated. So it seems that this non-coding RNA could regulate two different neighboring gene. Not all the gene in the locus, because this UB2V1 gene that is here in the middle is not affected. Okay. And then they confirm that this activity is correlating with the presence of mediator, because the same genes are also affected by the downregulation of MED components of mediator. And then because of this connection with mediator, they ask, is this non-coding RNA interacting with mediator? And so they do biochemical experiment to prove that, to see whether they interact, and they found an interaction. So here they do an RNA immunoprecipitation, RIP. So this is an immunoprecipitation between a protein and an RNA molecule, and they show that they do bind together. They actually first show the interaction with two different components of mediator, and then they show that this can lead to the purification of the old mediator complex. So that's just to prove that it does interact with mediator. And then finally, they do the most important experiment, which is to do looping analysis by chromatin conformation capture. And they show that there is looping of this non-coding RNA region with both the SNAP1 and the AURK gene, and that this looping is dramatically reduced when you remove the non-coding RNA, as well as when you remove the components of the mediator complex. So this experiment confirmed that mediator is required for the looping, as well as the non-coding RNA is required for the looping. So the conclusion of this paper is that there are non-coding RNAs that can be found associated with at least one. This is one particular example. There is one non-coding RNA that can be found interacting with the mediator, and that these seem to be required, this interacting module seem to be required for establishing the promoter enhancer looping. Now, one question that you may be asking is, this is the one specific RNA, long-coding RNA, that has been isolated in this different way because of its activating purposes. Is this an enhancer RNA? Are we talking about enhancer RNA? And so, is the enhancer RNA function to support promoter enhancer looping? This would be in agreement with those data presented in the estrogen receptor paper, where they suggested that the enhancer RNA were important for the looping. The answer is neither yes nor no. So if you read the discussion of the paper, they do address this question. So the enhancer RNA had been reported a couple of years earlier. The estrogen receptor paper, I think, had not been published yet. But the way in which they address the problem is to say that that no, these are an answer that they don't correspond. These are non-coding RNA that are a different class than the enhancer RNAs. And so if you read the literature, it says, okay, so a recent study shows that there are bidirectional transcripts named eRNA, and this is the neuronal paper that we discussed before. And then there is gene code data showing that the enhancer RNA have all those features. If we look at our RNAs, they are different. Our non-coding RNA are different because, first of all, the enhancer RNA are bidirectional, whereas these non-coding RNA, A as they call them, don't seem to be bidirectional. And then they say another difference is that the enhancer RNA don't seem to be associated with H3K4 trimethylation, whereas because they are enhancers, so they are associated with H3K4 monomethyl, whereas the enhancer the non-coding RNAs that we study are associated with H3K4 trimethyl. And then they also say that the enhancer, the non-coding RNA they study, this non-coding RNA A, show evidence of polyadenylation, whereas the enhancer RNA are non-polyadenylated. So they point all the differences. However, they conclude it's tempting to speculate that many of the non-coding RNA A may correspond to an enhancer, which makes sense because the way itself in which they have been identified is because of having an activating function, which is the definition of an enhancer. So it makes sense that they are transcribed in region that function as an enhancer. So about all the differences, my personal interpretation is that none of them is a reason to disprove the fact that they are an enhancer RNA. Because if you think about the thing that we have discussed earlier, for example, the polyadenylation. Yes, enhancer RNA are mostly non-polyadenylated, but there are also enhancer RNA that are polyadenylated. So that doesn't exclude the fact that they may be the same thing. Same thing for the bidirectional reasoning. Usually they're bidirectional, but that doesn't mean that all of them, they may be bidirectional. So I think it's a problem of classification. Obviously, when you are publishing a paper and you are discovering a new group of RNA, you want to make sure that you highlight the differences from what was known before. But I think there is not enough evidence to prove that this is a completely separate mechanism of regulation. And this is interesting because if we consider these as forms of enhancer RNA, then this paper really proves a connection between the enhancer RNA and the formation of the promoter enhancer looping, which is potentially interesting. Okay? Why RNA may be important for the formation of the enhancer promoter looping, it's unclear. However, it may be facilitating protein-protein interaction. There are a lot of examples now of cases where RNA-protein interaction can stabilize complexes, so it may be required for the stabilization of some of these interacting complexes. But again, those are all things that are ongoing. Okay, so yes, the last thing we should discuss is long-range interaction. So if you think about it, this model where there is one enhancer looping over a promoter and we study how the mechanism of it works, it's a simplification, right? We have seen the case of the beta globin gene where people have detected multiple interaction between multiple enhancer and a single gene, and that flower representation shows the complexity of the possible interaction. So is this just true in the case of the beta globin gene, or is something that is seen more often? And the answer is yes. Throughout the genome there are multitudes of long-range interactions, and this has been shown now by many studies using IC and other technologies. These are all technologies that are based on the 3C idea. So we have discussed the chromatin conformation capture approach. This approach has been developed, optimized to be associated with deep sequencing, so that one could test not only same thing than the ChIP-seq, right? When we discussed ChIP-seq the other day, we said when you do the ChIP experiment, you end up with a population where there is not only the interaction between the protein and the promoter you are interested in and you are looking at with the PCR primer, but there is also everything else is present in that pool. And so people wanted to understand what that everything else was, and they developed the ChIP-seq. Same thing here. If you think about when you do a 3C experiment, you end up having a tube where there are a lot of interaction, but then you do a PCR to test a specific gene, and so you extract only the information about that specific gene promoter couple you are interested in. However, in that particular tube, there is a lot of other information that can be gained if you can sequence everything and analyze it. And so people have done the same thing. They have developed a variation of the 3C approach to be able to sequence and measure all the interaction between different elements in the genome. And so this is, when you do the 3C genome-wide, people call it 4C. And then there is an explosion of Cs. It's basically the same idea. The only thing is that at the end they add an amplification steps in order to be able to sequence, and they have modified it by adding additional restriction enzymes, because If you think about it, when you do the 3C, you are digesting the DNA based on restriction enzymes. You use four base pair restriction enzymes. They are represented at a certain frequency in the genome, but you still get sometimes very large fragments. Now, if you want to sequence that, sequencing this large fragment may not be the right approach. And so to be able to further decrease the size of the fragment, people have inserted deletion with an additional enzyme. So you start to cut with the HindI3, for example, and then you add another cut with another enzyme. I think it's called MSP1. And so you further remove parts that are far away from your interaction. So you end up with a smaller circle where you can do intramolecular ligation and then DNA sequencing. Now, as I said, the field has really exploded from 3C, which was measuring single genes one by one. We moved to the 4C, which is the same thing, just the addition of another restriction enzymes, and then sequencing, and then the 5C, which is another slight variation with the which lead to sometimes it's called carbon codes. The other C of the CCCCCs, it's coming from carbon copy chromatin conformation capture, and this is because you design oligos that will anneal with the potential looping points. And so instead of sequencing the looping itself, you sequence the carbon copy of it. So you sequence the complementary one. You end up with a map that is a carbon copy of what is interacting. But it's the same idea. And then you have IC, which we'll discuss a little bit more. And then, so all these, all the Cs are based all on the same approach and lead to the identification of all kind of long-range interactions that are present in the cell. A slight variation is this, the chip loop or the chia PET, which is the same idea, but is for one specific transcription factor. So for each of them, there is an additional step where you are immunoprecipitating a specific transcription factor. So you are not interested in every possible loop in the cell, but you just look at the one that are associated with one transcription factor. That's the only difference between these techniques. So this is the chia PET, for example, and that's why I'm saying there is an additional chip step. So you isolate the loops as before, but then instead of sequencing every possible loop present in the cell, you select only the loops that are associated with your protein of interest, so let's say estrogen receptor. And so you end up having an enriched population of all the loops that are associated with ER, and then you do the same thing. You do intramolecular ligation, so things that are next to each other will be ligated together. You deproteinize, amplify, and then sequence. And so that will give you a map of all the long-range interaction in the cells that involve estrogen receptor or another transcription factor. The difference with the IC is that IC is the most advanced version of all the different Cs. So there is no chip associated. You are not selecting for one specific transcription factor. You are sequencing every possible loop that can be measured that is present in the cell. So all kind of long-range interaction. And the reason why is it's more efficient than the previous version is that there is an additional step where you enrich the population by filling the If you remember, when you cut with the restriction enzymes, you end up with a sticky end, right? Because the restriction enzyme site has a sticky end. So you can fill that sticky end with something. In this case, they fill it using biotinylated nucleotides. And this allows them to then purify the all the DNA that has been filled with the streptavidin column that interacts with biotin. So this allows for enrichment of this population, and therefore the technique is more sensitive. It's also a very difficult technique. So there are a few papers now that have been published with iSeq. It gives a very deep sequencing data. You get a lot of information. It allows to make broader maps, but both the technicality of the technique as well as the analysis of the technique is not easy. But still, it's a very, very, very powerful technique, and there are now some interesting papers published with this approach. So what does the data that come out of this? So what kind of conclusion have been derived from this type of study? So again, back to ENCODE, obviously, as they were doing everything, they did also long-range interaction experiments. And there is one particular paper that, from all that collection of the 30 ENCODEs paper, there is one that addressed the topic of long-range interaction. And they, in this particular study, they use 5C, so the carbon copy version of the chromatin conformation capture, doesn't really change much. The type of conclusion they reach are interesting. The first one is expected, and is the fact that if they compare different cell lines, you remember the power of ENCODE is that they can compare many different cell lines. And so when they compare cell lines, they found that the interaction between promoters and distal regulatory regions are cell-specific. So the ones that are found in one cell type are not found in another cell type, so not in another cell type. So of three cell lines that they compare, most of them were observed only in one of the three cell lines. And so that's not unexpected because of what we know about enhancers and the specificity of enhancer function. The second thing is that most of the interaction are not limited to the most proximal couple. Okay, so only 7% of the interaction links an enhancer to the most proximal promoter. And this is important because of what we were saying before, what we were discussing yesterday, right? That when people started to study enhancer and they were trying to identify the genes that were regulated by the enhancer, they would look at the genes nearby and then look whether they may be regulating them. And there are a lot of paper out there where they assume that a certain enhancer is linked to a certain gene because of proximity. We even looked at the fact that this morning some of the selection was done that way. However, this paper, this study, which is a genome-wide study, suggests that this is true only in a very limited number of cases, that the majority of the interaction are much more long range, and they involve couples that are not the enhancer with its most proximal promoter, but with genes that are located farther away. The last observation is, again, not surprising based on what we saw this morning for the beta-globin gene, but it's still interesting because it suggests that not only for the beta-globin genes, but for the entire genome now, there is each transcriptional star site seems to have interaction with a very large number of distal regulatory regions. And so some transcriptional star site shows up to 20 contemporary interaction with other regulatory regions. And so the maps that you may see in the literature look something like this, because obviously one of the The problem is that when you start to assemble all this data about long-range interaction, you need to find a way to represent them, right? And so people have come up with this circular representation, and the idea here is that you focus on a specific region, so you cannot represent the entire genome this way. In this case, these represent the ATF3 super enhancer locus. You can see that the super enhancer is right here, with about, I don't know, I think it's a million KB around. I don't remember the size of this. But what this shows is that there are concentric circles, right? So the circle on the outside shows where the genes are located. So it's genome information. And then the first circle here shows presence of H3K27 acetylation, and in fact it's enriched here where you have the super enhancer. Then it shows binding of, I think it's a transcription factor here, P1, yeah. So here they show binding of specific transcription factor, and then here they show binding of other transcription factor, in this case CTCF. And in the center, they show the long-range interaction that are identified by 4C, 5C, or IC, or whatever. And so if there are lines that connect this point, it means that this particular position here loops with this position, and so on and so forth. And so one thing that you can see from this thing is that there are some regions where the long-range interaction are concentrated. And then there are preferred positions of things that interact from this region all the way to this region. So this super enhancer has a lot of intra-enhancer interaction. And then it interacts with the other areas where different genes are located. And so these type of maps that have been made on a large scale suggest that there are domains. So things don't interact with everything else, but they interact within specific topologically associated domain, and this is called TADS. So this profile showed that the genome is organized in topologically associated domains, or TADS, which are regions within which you see elevated level of interaction, of long-range interaction. This is a different way of representing the iSeq data or long-range interaction data. The way in which this works is that what you show here is the frequency. It's like you linearize things, and then you show frequency of interaction between different points in the genome. So this line here is the sequence, basically. And then what you see represented up here is the normalized interacting counts, so the frequency that two points on the genome, let's say this point here and this point here, interact. If they do interact, then you design like a triangle here, and you should find signal from the angle of your triangle, because if this point here interact with this point here, then you will find signal from the interaction between these two, okay? And so the darker these points are, the more interaction there is between the two coordinates in the genome. And so these type of maps have facilitated the identification of TADS, so a region that interacts within each other, where there is increased frequency of interaction between different locations, are called TADS. Okay, so this is the same idea. It's just a drawing, so it looks a little bit better. You can see that if you imagine that down here you have a sequence of DNA, then interaction between different points can be observed by the false color representation here. And then the lowest part of the triangle is where the border of the topologically associated domain is, right? And there are some that are considered strong TADS border, because the two tats are completely separated, so you never find elements from this region that interacts from element from this region. So this area here is completely white. If it wasn't white, it meant that there could be at least some contacts. But the fact that it's white suggests that none of these pieces interact with none of these pieces. But there are also more weaker border where you do see some interaction. So there may be some inter-tad interaction. And represented here are also elements that usually are associated with the different tags. So there are architectural proteins that are found at the border. And so what are these architectural proteins? The most well studied is CTCF. So these are proteins that are found at the connecting point between this large looping. And so CTCF is one of these architectural proteins. The one interesting thing about CTCF is that CTCF binding sites are directional. So they can be directed only in one direction or the other direction. And so if you look at the orientation of the CTCF binding site on the genome, in relationship with the TAD borders, you find that usually at the border you have bidirectional CTCF binding site, because this direction here will interact with the CTCF on the other side of the border. There are also CTCF as well as architectural protein that are found inside the TADs, and this is because there are also smaller region that interact within the larger region, and those are sometimes called sub-TADs or intra-TADs interaction. In addition to CTCF, there is also cohesin that usually interact with the CTCF and stabilize this interaction. Here is represented for an answer promoter, but the same thing happens at the border of the TADs. So one thing about this representation is that I'll get to that in a minute. So if you look at how this can be can organize the genome on a larger scale than just single small tags, what comes up is a picture that looks a little bit like this, where the TADs allow to differentiate the region of genes that are co-regulated. And so you can find TADs that in which the chromatin is fully compacted, and those are silent regions. So this means that all the genes that are present within a certain domain, that certain domain are likely to be turned off. Whereas genes that are present within an active TAD or a TAD that is specifically active in a tissue-specific condition, those are genes that are likely to be co-regulated in that tissue-specific situation. Here is that type of representation. So if you think about the thing that you have studied before about the nuclear compartments, you can imagine that the TADs are one level of the intranuclear organization, the 3D spatial organization of the nucleus. And so active TADs are more likely to be located away from the lamina, whereas repressed TADs are more likely to be associated with the lamina. But then the important thing to consider is that within the TAD, you have additional intramolecular interaction, additional looping. And this is the looping of promoter and enhancer that we have been discussing before, right? So don't confuse the idea of the promoter and enhancer looping with the idea of the TAD. Those big TAD are big region where there are many genes included in each of the TAD. But then within each of the TAD, you can have additional looping of different enhancer and promoter couples. And so this is what is represented here much better than what I could say. You can see that when you look at IC data, you can identify large TADs that can be active or inactive. This shows the preference interaction between different points. And as you can see, in addition to the big signal up here, which indicates that there is a TAD that goes from this location here to this location here, there are also intra-TAD interactions. And these correspond to two things. So if you look at the big TAD, this can correspond to the spreading of chromatin modification that are associated with activation or repression. So if you consider that this is an active TAD, this one may be enriched in things like H3K36 methylation, which is a positive mark. Whereas if you look at the next TAD, which is inactive, you have an enrichment in H3K27 methylation. And the border of the TAD can serve to separate these two chromatin conformation domain. However, within the TADs, you can also find additional interaction. And so you have regions where the interaction is mediated probably by CTCF, and these are intra-TADs. But you also have smaller loops that you can detect up here, because like the loop in between this and this, for example, is identified by the presence of this frequency signal up here, and those are probably looping between enhancer and promoter genes. Okay, so this is the type of relationship between the TAD and the enhancer promoter looping. All of them can be detected using those iSeq deep sequencing approaches, but then each single RNA promoter enhancer promoter looping can be studied by doing single gene 3C approaches. And the last thing is, so one difference, when you think about the relationship between TADs and enhancer promoter looping, one thing to consider is the fact that TADs are mainly stable. Doesn't mean that they are always there, but they are mainly stable. So this big, large scale organization of the nucleus is usually pretty much conserved. So people have compared TADs profiling between different cell types, different tissue, and many of them are conserved. Whereas the enhancer promoter looping, so the intra-TADs contacts, are very flexible. They are tissue specific. Those are the ones that allow for the specificity of transcriptional regulation. So that's a big difference between large TADs and small TADs. But still, one other thing that you may find in papers, so I wanted to mention it because of that, is the fact that you can compare long-range interaction profiling from different cell types or different tissues. And so the type of graph that you see are something like this that looks very complicated, but what it is basically just one of these that is made in diagonal, and that has on one side one of the two conditions. So on this side, for example, is the same triangle that you were looking at before, shown for lung fibroblast, and then on the other side is the same map, but made for embryonic stem cell. And so by comparing the two sides, like it's the mirror, if you have the same type of signal, it means that those are TADs that are present in both cell types or both tissue, whereas there may be cases like this one where you do see a TAD in the embryonic stem cells and this is lost in the fibroblast. So there are cases of TADs that change, but generally they are considered pretty much conserved. Okay? And I think with this we are done. Yeah, this is just to remember how this idea of the domains can be associated with what we discussed yesterday about enhancer priming. Because if you remember, we were saying that when we go through differentiation and we go from embryonic stem cells to lineage determination, there may be priming of certain enhancer that are regulated differently in one cell type to another, and then you add the transcription factor binding site and those are regulated. And so usually the enhancers that are poised or primed in one cell lineage are held together within one domain. So these yellow lines here are insulator. Insulators are CTCF, are tough border, right? And so these enhancers are likely to be all within one domain, whereas the enhancers that are poised in a different lineage are likely to be in a different type of domain. And so these allow for all the things that are regulated at the same time to be close together. And probably it's a way to concentrate all the machinery that is required to regulate transcription of these genes in the same nuclear compartment. And with this, we are done. This is basically everything about transcriptional regulation. We'll see some example of it tomorrow, but we have covered most of the topic. Okay? Let me know if you have questions. As I said, I'm available tomorrow after class, so if you have a list of questions, I'm happy to answer. But if there are people that cannot be there tomorrow, send me emails and I'm happy to answer. That's it. Thank you.